I have a friend who's a reporter in New York, and he was down at Mar-a-Lago over New Year's weekend, and he said he spoke to Melania, and he came out, and his conclusion was she looked gorgeous, and she smelled really good. And I think, you know, she will put on perfect state dinners, and she will always look, she will always be photo ready, and she will remain very quiet. And that's something that people forget about Jacqueline Kennedy during the White House years. She was really quiet.
Journalist and best-selling author Dana Thomas. Pablo Larraín's new film depicts Jackie Kennedy in the midst of one of America's greatest tragedies. We'll take a closer look at the film and the cultural impact felt during that time of immense change on this special edition of The Cinema Show.
This house will always grow and should. It just seemed to me such a shame when we came here to find hardly anything of the past in the house.
Mr. President, the late Marilyn Monroe.
Well, now, your picture has been on the cover of almost all popular magazines, hasn't it?
No, not the Ladies' Home Journal.
That you would like, would you?
Yes.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade in downtown Dallas.
Her brow furrows, her lips are drawn. She holds back her tears, but she can't hide her anger.
Hello from Midori House in London, I'm Ben Rylan. Today's program is taking a slightly different approach to our usual format. This weekend, the United States officially has a new president. Every 8 years, the presidential inauguration is a chance for many Americans to look back at the various leaders who have shaped the state of the nation. And even if the dawn of the new president is more a cause for concern than celebration, there's clearly a mood of nostalgia in the air. Today we're looking at the history of America on the screen and the violent, rapid shift that took place in the years following the death of President Kennedy. From the healthy cynicism at play in 1940's His Girl Friday to the jaded societal shift that followed the Nixon era, as seen in 1976's All the President's Men, right up to the new film Jackie that puts JFK's First Lady at the center of her own film, played by Natalie Portman.
I've come to discuss tomorrow.
The Attorney General relayed to me your desire for a more modest ceremony.
I've changed my mind.
I'm sorry?
I said I've changed my mind. We will have a procession, and I will walk to the cathedral with the casket.
Like few before her, Jackie was a first lady whose fame surpassed the White House role assigned to her. Much of that is due to those around her who helped cultivate her real life into something resembling the perfect celebrity. Shortly after JFK's death, Andy Warhol began a series of portraits of the now former First Lady. The media's obsession with the White House and the role of the president's wife was erupting like never before. Warhol captured the spectacle in his art, the only way he knew how. But our story today really starts decades before President Kennedy ever entered office. At a time when America found itself on the brink of the Second World War, and a proud sense of patriotism swept the nation. The Front Page was produced for the stage in 1928, and it's been adapted to the screen several times, most notably in 1940's His Girl Friday. A version that swapped one of the male protagonists for a strong, independent female, played to perfection by Rosalind Russell, opposite Cary Grant.
How long is it since we've seen each other?
Oh, well, let's see. I spent 6 weeks in Reno, then Bermuda, about 4 months, I guess. Seems like yesterday to me.
Maybe it was yesterday, Hildy. Been seeing me in your dreams?
No, Mama doesn't dream about you anymore, Wally. You wouldn't know the old girl now.
Yes, I would. I'd know you anytime, any place.
Anywhere. you're repeating yourself, Walter. That's the speech you made.
The 1940 film version is often credited as inspiring more people to enter the world of journalism than any other picture.
Today, January 14th, 1952, 7 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. We are in NBC's World Communications Center in the heart of Radio City, New York. We are in touch with the world. We'll tell you what's happening today.
With the Second World War relegated to the history books, American culture took an optimistic turn throughout the 1950s. At the tail end of the 40s, a young Doris Day was convinced to transform her singing career into one on the screen by auditioning for the musical Romance on the High Seas.
If you're seeking recreation and your mind needs a vacation, from the troubles of the day you want to flee. Oh, if the Arctic makes you...
It proved to be the big screen break that she never anticipated, and in 1950, Doris Day was voted as the favourite star of US servicemen in Korea. This was a new America, one that considered itself a wholesome place underpinned by shared morals and common values. And many of the nation's films produced during this period reflected that belief. Billy Wilder's wistful romance, Sabrina, secured Audrey Hepburn as a legend of the screen a year after her sensational debut in Roman Holiday. Disney further proved that feature animations were here to stay with Alice in Wonderland and Peter Pan, while Betty Davis and Gloria Swanson demonstrated the fleeting nature of celebrity in All About Eve and Sunset Boulevard.
I am big. It's the pictures that got small.
But beneath the technicolor surface of Hollywood's colourful view of itself, all was not well.
In fact, I was talking to one of my Democrat friends the other day. He told me very frankly he was going to vote for censure. He said, not because of the silly reasons given by the Watkins Committee. He said, but because you labelled the Democrat Party as the party of communism.
Today, Senator Joseph McCarthy is remembered almost synonymously with the House Un-American Activities Committee and the Hollywood Blacklist, a widely discredited attempt by the US government to stamp out perceived communist beliefs, most famously in Hollywood. Otto Preminger was one of a handful of filmmakers unafraid of challenging what was deemed appropriate for audiences of the era. His films of the 1940s included some of the most striking examples of film noir, such as 1944's Laura and Where the Sidewalk Ends in 1950. America's political culture was about to undergo a change unlike anything ever before. And although no one knew it yet, a national tragedy was about to strike.
And I decided everyone should be trying to help Jack in whatever way they could. And that was the way I could do it the best. By making it always a climate of affection and comfort and detente when he came home.
Being First Lady of the United States must be a very strange position to be in. Few official roles come with such immense and non-specific expectations. That's partly because being First Lady isn't actually a job. There's no salary, and the duties that come with the title stay well outside of the official realm of the presidency. Pablo Larraín's new film, Jackie, largely revolves around some of those unofficial expectations. Jackie must look beautiful, and she does. She must accompany her husband on official trips, waving happily at the massive crowds gathered to catch a glimpse at the perfect couple. A carefully cultivated American dream. And when tragedy strikes, Jackie becomes the de facto mourner-in-chief.
Before she even married, she was an important society girl. She was a debutante. And then she was a journalist, which, of course, is close to my heart. She was a very good photojournalist.
That's New York Times best-selling author Dana Thomas. Among the books she's written is the double biography Gods and Kings, The Rise and Fall of Alexander McQueen and John Galliano. She's also a contributing editor at T, the New York Times style magazine.
She was raised to be a very fine young woman. She spoke French and she dressed well and she went to the right schools. And so she was going to land a good husband. and that she managed to find that young senator, that young dashing senator, was exactly how she was raised and bred to be.
And then she managed to carve this place in American culture and American history. And during the time that she was in the White House, it seemed as though she personified what was considered the perfect first lady. Is that something that people of the 1960s would have been looking at in Jackie Kennedy and seeing? Or is that maybe something that we more read into her history in retrospect?
No, I think she was like Michelle Obama has been for us for the last 4 years or 8 years. She brought all of that culture with her to the White House and all of that style. And you have to remember, I mean, if you think back of first ladies that preceded her, there was Mamie Eisenhower, and there was Bess Truman, and there was Eleanor Roosevelt. And while they were, Eleanor Roosevelt particularly, formidable women, they weren't particularly known for their style or their grace. And I would say probably the last first lady who embodied that similar kind of style, elegance, and class was Edith Galt Wilson, Woodrow Wilson's wife, during World War I. And she came from a very good Washington family. And before that, we had what? Dolly Madison. I mean, it's been a long time. There have been very few very elegant and well-raised women as first ladies. And so Jackie brought that to the White House. She cared about things like how the table looked. She understood the importance of image, having been a photojournalist, and put always the best face and image forward for the family and for the White House. And she made sure everyone was impeccably dressed and looked perfect all the time, and that they always were happy, even if there were moments when she was dying inside, as we later found out, because of her husband's infidelities. She built the myth of the First Lady in a way that had never been done before.
What do we expect from a First Lady? It's famously this, we call it a job, even though it's not really a job. It's a set of expectations that all seem to be unofficial. What do you think America expects of its First Lady, and how has that changed over at least recent history?
Right. Well, that again goes back to Dolly Madison. But we expect her to be a very good hostess, to receive state visits, and Nancy Reagan, of course, excelled greatly at that as well. And also to be supportive of her husband, and, you know, hopefully that when everything's in full-on crisis, she's there helping prop him up and keep him clear-minded. She's also a bit of the person who does the outreach for the White House to everyday Americans, to voters, to constituents. So that's why they often have campaigns, like Mrs. Obama's had her nutrition campaign and planting the garden, with the idea that if they can have a garden at the White House, why can't you have one in your backyard and get out and exercise? And since Jacqueline Kennedy, they've had their missions, actually since Eleanor Roosevelt. Eleanor Roosevelt was very involved and active with the constituency of the United States, the American voters. But Mrs. Kennedy's was cultural. She wanted to create a ministry of culture like they have in France, and later came from her initiatives the National Endowment of the Arts and the National Endowment of the Humanities. And she wanted to bring culture to the people, so she had evenings like the Nobel Prize winner's dinner, and she would have, you know, great artists and musicians come and perform at the White House and then have it broadcast so that Americans could see it. Later, she was the force behind creating the Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts in Washington, D.C., and really wanted to make culture something that was not for the elite, but for everyone.
I was never any different once I was in the White House than I was before. But the press made you different. Suddenly everything that had been a liability before, your hair, that you spoke French, that you didn't just adore to campaign and you didn't bake bread with flour up to your arms. You know, everyone thought I was a snob and hated politics. Well, Jack never made me feel that I was a liability to him, but I was. And then I was having a baby and couldn't campaign. Then when we got in the White House, all the things that I'd always done suddenly became wonderful. Because anything the First Lady does that's different, everyone sees us on. And I was so happy for Jack, especially now that it was only 3 years together, that he could be proud of me then.
It feels as though something that's also expected of the First Lady today is for her to be very graceful and for her to embody some sort of American elegance and style. Whether that's fair or not, I don't know, but that seems to be something that's placed upon the role of First Lady, at least in our modern times. When do you think that expectation started?
Well, that happened definitely with Jacqueline Kennedy. And then maybe again at a time with Edith Wilson, because she was also so stylish. But like I said, sort of Eleanor Roosevelt, Bess Truman, and Mamie Eisenhower, while they were sort of grandmotherly, weren't necessarily socialite style plates, fashion plates. And Mrs. Kennedy definitely put that forward. I mean, when she came to Paris with the president on the state visit, and the president said, "I am the man, the gentleman who accompanied Jacqueline Kennedy to Paris," that sort of says everything. And she wore Givenchy to a dinner in Versailles and just looked spectacular with her hair up in a massive chignon by Alexandre de Paris. She just knew exactly what to do and sort of set a bar so impossibly high for anyone ever to reach. It's interesting because Melania Trump, when asked which First Lady she would most like to try and embody, she said Betty Ford, which I thought was a very curious answer, and then Jacqueline Kennedy. I would say most First Ladies at some point have said, "I would like to try to pick up something that Jackie did," because it was all grand. Except maybe Nancy Reagan, because she had that in her as well, and I would suspect tried to reset the scale on First Ladies by hopefully being the Jackie Kennedy of her generation, of her era, and people would say, "I want to be like Nancy Reagan," but that hasn't happened.
Various accounts of the lives of both John F. Kennedy and Marilyn Monroe claim that the pair had an affair. And many claim that Jackie was all too painfully aware of her husband's infidelities. In the early 1960s, they were perhaps the most famous women in America. And their styles, well, they couldn't have been further apart.
No, her style wasn't terribly sexy. It was always appropriate. I mean, you think about the black cocktail dress and pearls, or the Balenciaga-like trapeze dresses, or those perfect suits. And most of her look from that era is still a uniform in Washington, D.C. I mean, you go to a cocktail party and you will see the black dress and pearls, and you go to the office and you'll see that little boxy suit on legislative assistance. And it's why it also keeps circling back into fashion pretty regularly. I remember back when I was working at the Washington Post in the late 1980s, I did a column where I compared suits and clothes from that year. It was about 1989 or not, 88 or 89, by Bill Blass and by Calvin Klein and by, who else, Oscar de la Renta. And I could find in our fabulous photo file of Jacqueline Kennedy as First Lady almost identical outfits. And I ran them side by side saying, "Look, fashion really hasn't changed much. Jackie always is in fashion." You could probably do the same almost every year. You could pull out a couple pictures from Jackie's White House years and find something on the runway that's a descendant of it, because it is always appropriate. Marilyn, on the other hand, was just a bomb, as we know. And while her sex appeal is always in fashion, what she wore necessarily wasn't.
And now for the next 30 minutes, as the world turns.
Here is a bulletin from CBS News. In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade in downtown Dallas. The first reports say that President Kennedy has been seriously wounded by this shooting.
The 22nd of November changed the course of American history. Life magazine had been due to run with a cover story on Navy quarterback Roger Staubach. Instead, it went with 35 pages on the Kennedys, including 4 pages of stills taken from the famous Kodachrome motion picture sequence shot by Abraham Zapruder. For Americans, it was a day of national mourning. For Jackie Kennedy, it was the day she lost her husband. In just a few short moments, she was thrust from the role of First Lady into the world's most famous widow. It's this period of Jackie's life that forms much of the basis of Pablo Larraín's new film. And yet, while we can only imagine how it must have felt for a woman to suffer under such intense scrutiny, the truth is that, for Jackie, life eventually went on.
She was an icon very early on and lived up to it, and then connecting with Onassis, my gosh. and living that fabulous late 60s, early 70s life in her Valentinos and Capri. I mean, didn't we all want to be jet set? She sort of evolved so beautifully with the times and always epitomized each moment. You think of that Ron Galea photograph of her with the big sunglasses and the ripped sweater and the trousers, her hair flying. I mean, that's one of the most iconic paparazzi pictures of all time. And she just looked so modern. She was always modern. She was always of the moment and modern. And it seemed, at least, that nothing would stop her from achieving anything that she wanted. And that was kind of cool. She was like a feminist before feminism.
From the tiny chapel on the Greek island of Skopios, the first public appearance of Mrs. Aristotle Onassis, formerly, of course, Mrs. Jacqueline Kennedy, widow of the late president. The millionaire ship owner and his bride seemed oblivious of the pouring rain and the persistence of newsmen alike.
Journalist and best-selling author Dana Thomas. Still to come, just before America lost a president, Hollywood lost one of its greatest stars.
Tonight we'll be going first to Weston, Connecticut, where photographer Milton Green, his wife, and their friend and house guest Marilyn Monroe will be waiting for us.
This is The Cinema Show. Stay tuned.
If you're enjoying today's program, then you've probably got excellent taste in movies. So let me tell you about a little secret. It's called MUBI, and among the many titles playing right now is the debut film from screen sensation Xavier Dolan.
I just think that what matters in making movies is that all the elements are working and walking at once in synchronicity.
And if today's program has whet your appetite for some American history, you can also catch the classic newspaper comedy, His Girl Friday.
I still say that anybody that can write like that ain't going to give it up permanently to sew socks for a guy in the insurance business.
From Andrea Arnold to William Wyler, MUBI is the curated movie site of cult, classic and award-winning films. Sample a whole month for free now at MUBI.com/monocle. That's MUBI/monocle. Now, on with the show.
Marilyn, I was asking Milton what you thought of that look cover that he did of you.
I liked it very much.
This is The Cinema Show on Monocle 24. I'm Ben Rylan. Today we're looking back at the cultural shift that ripped through America following the death of President Kennedy. The stories of JFK and the world's most famous movie star, Marilyn Monroe, are delicately intertwined. One biographer claims that not only was Jackie aware of her husband's affairs, but that Marilyn was actually convinced that the president was going to leave his wife and marry her. Author Christopher Anderson claims in his book, These Few Precious Days, that Marilyn apparently telephoned Jackie to tell her all about the president's plan to make her his new first lady, to which Jackie is said to have responded with the blasé cynicism of someone not entirely shocked to hear that her husband has a weakness for beautiful blondes. Marilyn Monroe's battles with mental illness are well documented, and it might be conceivable that, towards the end of her life, she did believe in such a fanciful scenario. If she did, the dream never went anywhere, and like most things in Marilyn's life, it didn't last long.
One of the most famous stars in Hollywood history is dead at 36. Marilyn Monroe was found dead in bed, under circumstances that were in tragic contrast to her glamorous career as a comic talent.
The year before the horror of losing its president, America lost its most famous film star. Marilyn Monroe went to bed on the 5th of August, 1962, and she never woke up.
I wanna be loved by you just...
The role of celebrities has been central to America's cultural identity for well over a century. It's impossible to know exactly how profound an impact the early 1960s had on the nation's collective psychology. On the screen, however, the nation's mood seemed to take a decidedly optimistic tone.
I wanna be loved by you. The deedly 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 dum. Boop boopy doop.
Congratulations, Calamity.
Fellas, nobody else on earth could have done it but Calam. I'll bet if she went after Sitting Bull, she'd bring him back, too.
Did you see the show? Did you see Miss Adam work, huh?
What's it like in the big city?
Boys, Chicago's the biggest noise in Illinois.
just flew in from the Windy City. The Windy City is mighty pretty, but they ain't got what we got.
Throughout the 1950s, Doris Day cultivated an image as America's sweetheart. If Marilyn had been the woman to send America's men wild and strike fear into their wives, Doris was the pinnacle of suburban household dreams. And if these two versions of the American female could be seen as being at battle with one another, the conflict came to a symbolic end when, in the year following Marilyn's death, Doris Day became the star of Marilyn's final unfinished film, originally titled Something's Got to Give, now renamed Move Over, Darling.
Our lips shouldn't touch.
Move over, darling.
I like it too much.
Doris Day's persona really was America's dream, at least for a while. She was the top box office star from 1960 to 1964. But the thing about dreams is that eventually you have to wake up. Films like The Manchurian Candidate, released just prior to Kennedy's death, hinted at government mistrust. Dr. Strangelove in 1964 tapped into America's growing fear over its own nuclear capabilities. In some ways, the themes at play were merely a matured form of the anxieties expressed by the schlocky science fiction diversions a decade earlier.
Why should you build such a thing?
There were those of us who fought against it, but in the end we could not keep up with the expense involved in the arms race, the space race, and the peace race.
As Eric Schlosser remarked upon the film's 50th anniversary in 2014, almost everything in Dr. Strangelove was true. And that was before the age of Trump. But if anyone thought the popularity of Doris Day had doomed ideas of sexual liberalism, they were very wrong indeed.
Hello, darkness, my old friend.
Films like The Graduate in 1967, with its cheeky premise providing a thin mask for a much nastier core, presented a set of suffocated characters dominated by the societal expectations of the 1950s, while also ushering in a new age of sexual freedom. Visitors to the Henry Ford Museum in Detroit can see the chair Abraham Lincoln was sitting in when he was shot dead in 1865. They can also see the car that President Kennedy was travelling in with his wife when he was killed. But that pink suit worn by Jackie Kennedy on that fateful day won't be seen by many people alive today. It was delivered to the National Archives with a note on the stationery of Jackie's mother that read, "Jackie's suit and bag worn November 22nd, 1963. Still stained with the blood of a president, it's stored in a climate-controlled vault just outside Washington, D.C., where it will be kept hidden until the year 2103. That brings us to the end of today's program. Jackie is screening in cinemas in many parts of the world right now. The Cinema Show was edited by Kieran Matthew Banerjee and researched by Yolene Goffin. Don't forget to subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your audio. Next week on The Cinema Show, we're taking off for the Sundance Film Festival. Until then, I'm Ben Ryland. Thank you for listening.